I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The championship season is over, and what a season it was.
But the best is yet to come. It's the playoffs.
Who will make it to the Premier League?
And who will be left heartbroken at Wembley?
Stay across it all with the second tier.
We're bringing you episodes after every leg.
And in between, we're revisiting the greatest moments in playoff history.
It's real conversation with two real championship obsessives.
So you can be in the know about everything happening in the playoffs.
And share all your new knowledge in the pub with your mates.
So come join us.
We're your one-stop shop for the playoffs.
Search second tier in your podcast app
and hit subscribe.
For Pitty, and he got the net in!
Yeah!
It's in! And the Beerlof goal! Daily Blind!
Nu via Sneijder en aan de linkerkant Blind naar Robben. Neem aanwaaien en schieten! Kappen schieten!
Ja! Yeah!
Ja! Richting Casillas gaat erbij! Hij zit erin! Stefan de Vrij! Stefan de Vrij maakt hem!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Opposite with me, of course, is Jonathan Wilson. And today on the pod, we have Jonathan Liu, sports writer for The Guardian and columnist of the year in the 2019 Sports Journalism Association Awards. Jonathan, pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Two Jonathans on the pod today. My goodness, what a treat. Now, today we are looking at the Group B fixture in the 2014 World Cup in Brazil that ended Spain 1, Netherlands 5. Jonathan, why have you chosen this game?
I was at it.
Right.
It was an interesting game, I think, in lots of reasons. I mean, obviously, in the context of the competition, it sent shockwaves through the whole World Cup. But also it seemed to mark the end of something in retrospect, that great Spanish era, and I suppose set up what has been the defining theme of football in the years since, which is basically possession against counter-attack and the sort of back and forth between those two different theories.
Yeah, and of course, Spain actually had, well, I think, 64% possession in this game. So, yeah, it was the end of, it did feel like the end of Spain's dominance.
Yeah, it felt like the end of an era, which then was sort of confirmed when Spain lost to Chile, 5-6 days later.
Yeah.
But it's also, what an extraordinary narrative it is that the man to end it should be the man who began it.
Yeah.
That Van Gaal, who sort of, I guess Cruyff begins it, but Van Gaal sort of takes on that possession football, that it's under him, that you have your Mourinho working as his assistant, that you have Ronald Koeman briefly working as his assistant, but you also have Luis Enrique and more significantly Pep Guardiola playing for him. And so that's a huge part of the development of this Spanish style. And then he's the man who, turning his back on his philosophy, you know, or amending it, as he would say it.
Like, yeah, I was going to say.
Necessary
yeah.
evolution. he's the one who destroys it.
Very much like Rembrandt. I mean, as I remember writing something for the... I was working at the Telegraph at the time, writing something the following night. It was about 4 a.m. in a hotel in Salvador, writing about this story I'd heard about Rembrandt having to basically take a hacksaw to one of his own paintings because he was struggling. He was really struggling. He was late in his career. And he painted something that he really loved, but it was too big for the person who wanted to buy it just wanted it hacked down. So he had to take a chainsaw and just cut it in about a third to about a third of the size. And that's essentially what Van Gaal did.
Yeah, I would say so.
He created something he loved and then destroyed it.
Yeah. I love the fact that it's
for money.
I like this Van Gaal, who's the one who says, right, I've had enough of this. We need a sea change in football. Because Vicente del Bosque was a Spain manager who had unbelievable success at international level. I mean, Spain had won 3 international tournaments going into that one. And really, the side wasn't that different in terms of personnel. Diego Costa was the big one who'd come in. A more traditional striker.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a sense that the decline had been sort of foreshadowed. We knew that they weren't quite what they'd been, and they'd struggled to find a forward. Diego Costa, naturalised Brazilian. That was, I don't want to say it was an act of desperation, but it definitely, the fact that they...
It was a surprise.
They went for a player who sort of stylistically was so different to what they'd had before. To David Villa, I think it was probably the best fit for that team, but even Torres. I think that suggested that there was a bit of disquiet in Spain and that they didn't quite, they weren't quite happy with how things were going.
But if you look at the two sides, though, I mean, the names in the Spain side are far bigger.
Yeah, there are a lot of the names who were there in 2008 and time passes and people get old. You know, you look at that midfield of Busquets, Xabi Alonso and Xavi. It's a great midfield, but by this point, it's a very slow midfield.
Yes, but again, though, you still wouldn't see them going out in the first round.
No,
the World Cup and getting beat 5-1 here.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It was foreshadowed in the sense that we thought it weren't quite what they'd been. I don't think anybody expected this sort of devastation. Because I don't think anybody really thought the Dutch were particularly good.
Yeah.
And Chile, although they'd had a very good World Cup 4 years earlier, there was a sense of, to what extent has the Bielsa legacy been lost under Borghi? The question was always there with Chile until the following year, until 2015, when they won the Copa America for the first time, is when the pressure's really on, can they do it? Or does this sort of century of near misses that drag them down? The other team in the group were Australia, which I think people expected them to, all those other three teams to get past Australia. You'd have thought of Spain plus one rather than the other two going through, absolutely.
Yeah, well, what did you think, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, in hindsight, what Spain really needed to do was kind of speed up this transition to the new generation a lot quicker. But at the time, having lived through 6 years of utter dominance, it just seemed like, turning up with Busquets and Xavi and Iniesta and David Silva, and I think Fabregas came on later. Essentially, turning up with six or seven midfielders would be.
Not all of them were that. I mean, Busquets were still not old.
No,
Fabregas,
I mean,
you mentioned
they weren't old, but they were playing essentially, the same kind of football that they had been in 4 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, this is maybe one of the reasons why no team has, I think, since Brazil in '62 has retained the World Cup. Which is extraordinary, actually, if you think about it. But it just shows how quickly these cycles turn. And often teams are tempted to go with, what's brought them success in the past. And I remember at the time people were saying, well, they might not be what they were, but it's Holland who are the ones that should be struggling to qualify here rather than Spain.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and at this point of age, although it was a very experienced side, you look at that team, Sergio Ramos, Piqué, Busquets, Jordi Alba. They've all still, yeah, but the four of them are all still in and around the Spain squad.
Yeah,
you know, sort of 4, 5, 6 years later.
Yeah. But I think with Spain's dominance, you know, when they won those three tournaments in a row, going into this one, it was just so difficult to imagine anything beyond that. It was, you know, it was
kind of inconceivable.
It's a bit like when Tony Blair was in charge. You thought, sure, will this be forever now?
Yeah, this is like if Blair had actually carried on to the 2010 election and got his ass handed to him by Cameron, and the Tories had got a 60-seat landslide. It's kind of like that.
It is.
It's seeing the team that you've almost sort of grown up with thinking are kind of invincible, or at the very least, you know, they were still finding a way, just not just getting beaten, but totally being schooled.
Yeah.
And that's what made it, I think, such a seminal moment, I think.
Yeah. I was at the Chile game, this game, this was the second day of the World Cup. So the first day I'd been at Brazil, Croatia, the opening game, and I was sharing a flat. That game was in São Paulo. I was sharing a flat in Rio with Miguel Delaney for the tournament. Miguel obviously is half Irish, half Spanish.
Good old Migsy.
Very proud of his Spanish roots. And so we flew from São Paulo to Rio the next day. He was on a later flight, obviously. I then had to wait because his flight was delayed, obviously. I had to write something for telly on. I think Mexico Cameroon was the first game. So we kind of rushed to the apartment. The game's just starting, so I sit down and kind of start working on the game. He tries to make me a cup of coffee, but he can't work a coffee machine. And that's not really relevant. The relevant bit is watching his distress and his darlings being torn apart made it so sweet.
Yeah, because being obviously an Ireland fan, Miguel, he always had Spain to balance it out.
Yeah, he supports both. He, you know, his mom is Spanish. He's legitimately a Spain fan.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was because you watched him go through the five stages of grief and kind of rest. Because I mean, because especially when Spain take the lead, he sort of thinks, it's a natural order of things.
There's two things that you'll never need an excuse for, Jonathan. One of them comes up quite regularly in this podcast is a Sunderland mention, and the second one is a dig at Miguel.
Yeah. You know? I noticed you got Chile in within about 45 seconds as well.
Yeah, indeed.
No, this is the first ever World Cup game I went to. It's the first ever tournament game I went to.
Oh, wow. So what an introduction.
What a ridiculous start.
It's incredible. I mean, certainly the group stages of that tournament was some of the most fun football I've ever been to.
Mm-hmm.
My first ever tournament game, was Lebanon v Iran in 2000 at the Asian Cup.
But yeah, anyway. Right. Mine would have been
mine too,
Ivory Coast 3, Mali 0 at the African Cup in 2008.
It's quite an introduction. I mean, the stadium in Salvador, like a lot of the stadiums they built for that World Cup had been like totally rebuilt. There was like an exclusion zone about I think a kilometre or maybe a kilometre and a half outside the ground. So you basically had to walk the last mile. It was very hot, very humid, about 28 degrees. And there was about five flights of stairs to climb up to the press box.
Mm.
And I sat through the first half, and the Telegraph had equipped us with these sort of MiFi, like mobile internet devices, but the internet wasn't working. The Wi-Fi at the ground wasn't working. My mobile internet wasn't working. I just couldn't get online at all. So having sat through the first half, just sort of scrabbling around with gadgets and wires, I went back to the press room and watched the whole of the second half from three stories below the ground in a deserted press room, thinking, gosh, I don't think this Diego Costa colour piece is really the story anymore. But because of the late deadlines in the UK, that was kind of what. So the first edition, the Telegraph readers who got the first edition of the newspaper, which is mainly outside the south of England, would have read about how Diego Costa's big night fell flat.
My goodness.
And then, a bit of a rewrite for second edition.
Yeah. But what about the Netherlands, though? They won the game handsomely and would go on to finish third at the tournament. Van Gaal back in charge of the Netherlands. He'd failed, really. In a previous podcast, we talk about the moment where that was sealed when Ireland beat Netherlands 1-0 and they didn't qualify for 2002. But he's back in the job. Netherlands qualified pretty handsomely. 9 wins, I think, and one draw. And they were looking good, although the expectation among the Dutch was a little bit low.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Strootman, who'd been vital to how they'd been playing, had got injured, serious knee injury. And Van Gaal was a widespread concern about their defence. He felt they were very weak in one-on-one situations. And the famous story, although Van Gaal himself slightly disputes this. imagine that, Van Gaal disputing something. was that there was a game between Ronald Koeman's Feyenoord or his PSV? His Feyenoord against PSV. And they had De Vrij and Martin Zindi and I think Jan Mat were all in that team. And so Van Gaal went to watch it with Van Persie, who was his, you know, his captain. And Koeman had switched to a back three. A huge, I mean, this is the most controversial thing that could possibly happen in the Netherlands.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Koeman seeing this being this sort of the torchbearer of the Barcelona way.
4-3-3.
4-3-3. And he's gone to a back three. But Van Gaal watches it in this game. And again, he says he had the idea of a back three back in the 90s when he was at Barcelona. That he realised teams sat deep against him. If you played with a back three, you got better coverage of the pitch. But anyway, after this, he decides, right, we're going to try a back three. And that then means you've got cover for these defenders who aren't so good in one-on-one situations. And so they tried it. They had three more friendlies before the World Cup. And they used it against Ecuador, which they drew 1-1, and a 1-0 win over Ghana. So it hadn't been a massive success.
Yeah, and that lowered the expectations.
But the difference he made was he moved De Jong deeper to put, you know, give cover in front of the back three and move Robin infield to get his pace through the middle. And of course, it's Robin's pace, which ended up absolutely devastating this you know, quite pedestrian Spanish side.
It's essentially a 7-3 because I think it's De Guzman, Jonathan De Guzman, alongside De Jong, and they've hardly ever get forward.
Broke forward, yeah. So, and you know, again, the complete antithesis of what total football is.
Yeah.
Almost all the creativity went through Schneider. Schneider with Robin sort of running off him and then Van Persie as a centre forward.
But I suppose afterwards everybody was talking about this. Oh, this is the return. I think the BBC pundits were saying this is the return of total football, which just kind of shows
nonsense.
People don't know what words mean.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, yeah. And real talent in that side.
But should I tell the Van Gaal story?
Please do.
Yeah, I know, I can see you gagging for it. So when I was writing for Barcelona Legacy, I interviewed Van Gaal. Two and a half hours in a West London hotel the day of the League Cup final, and it is the most stressful and intense 2.5 hours I've ever spent. He is such a difficult man. I love him, but he is a very difficult man. And so I kind of, you know, wanted to talk about, you know, philosophies and you know, this switch to back three is pretty significant. So, you know, why did he do it? And he looked at me in the way that Louis van Gaal looks at people and goes, who was my defence? And I was like, oh God, he actually wants me to name them. So you've got Louis van Gaal staring at you and you're having to go, Bruno Martins-Indy, Stefan de Vrij, Ron Vlaar, Daryl Janmaat. Oh, and when I named four, he thankfully ends the torture because, hey, you are good.
Got an endorsement from the great man.
Yeah, and then I sent him the transcript of the interview and the endorsement stopped. But
he was unhappy with what he said.
Yeah, I mean, I literally sent him a transcript
of
everything he'd said, so that, you know, he'd clarify anything. Obviously, he's working in a second language, so, you know, I think from a, you know, an ethical point of view, it's a healthy thing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't letting him write the piece, but it was sort of, you know, make sure these words are what you want to have said.
Yeah.
And he emailed me back going, I'm very disappointed in this. This is like something you'd read in The Sun. So, Louis, they're your words.
You hadn't edited anything at that point.
This is just what you said. Like.
Superb. All right, chaps. Let's have a quick break and then we'll talk about the match itself. See you in a moment, everybody.
Wat een bal. En ik zei het, één keer sta je geen buitenspel. Paf! 1-1. Bang! In the face.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This episode of the Football Ramble is sponsored by BetterHelp. Life throws many different challenges at us, and as a result, we all have our own sources of stress. Whether big or small, those stresses can impact our lives in unpredictable ways, and if we don't address them, they can have an outsized and unwanted impact. Therapy is a safe place in which we can address these issues, learn to understand them, and find ways to work through them. Having therapy can be beneficial to anybody, not just people who've experienced major traumas, even if you may have not considered it before. It could be simply a time for you to get things off your chest, a way to learn positive coping skills, or how to set boundaries. Ultimately, it can be whatever you need it to be. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire and BetterHelp will match you to a licensed therapist. You can even switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Welcome back to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Right then, let's get down to it. So, Jonathan, from your position in the press box at the game, the match begins, and I mean, at no point other than until the fifth goes in, it doesn't really ever feel like it's a 5-1 game for me.
No, I mean, Spain, well, they didn't dominate the early stages, but they certainly controlled a lot of the ball, and they had quite a few early chances. And I think Robben sprung them. No, Schneider sprung the offside trap quite early. But apart from that, it was essentially Spain.
But that was the warning, though, wasn't it? And Casillas made, stood up and kicked it away. But that in retrospect, the warning was there that Schneider had got behind them.
Yeah. But I think Silva got behind the offside trap once, and then obviously Diego Costa, who I decided going to write my sidebar about. He's the story here, mm-hmm. Diego Costa, and getting really sort of a torrent of boos from the Brazilian crowd. They were calling him Diego Viejo, which basically means it's like homophobic. It's a homophobic slur.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wins a penalty.
Because the Brazilians were so disappointed because he wasn't playing for them, of course.
Yeah, essentially. Country, yeah, and I don't think he was that. I don't think he was fully fit. No. Certainly didn't look fully fit. But he won a penalty, and then Spain converted and got an early lead. And you think, okay, the natural order of things has sort of been worked out here.
Yeah, and that's right. Spain go 1-0 up. Xabi Alonso puts away the penalty.
Well, and it's exactly what Van Gaal had been worried about. That his defenders in 1-on-1 battles weren't good enough, and De Vrij sort of gets lured into sort of making a lunging challenge, and he catches Costa's trailing leg,
and especially with a forward like Costa as well. Who?
Oh, I mean, look, it's one of those where I think Costa knew exactly what he was doing when he turned back inside. He was thinking, "I'm probably going to get caught here," but it's a foul.
It is. And then David Silva has a chance for 2-0, which Cillessen in goal stands up well with. But again, like, it's so odd watching the highlights, because you see Spain go 1-0 up; they're looking fairly comfortable. I know Schneider's sprung the offside trap, but he didn't score. And then Silva has that chance, and you're just thinking, this ends 5-1. Do you know, it's such a strange
change. Everything changes with the Van Persie goal. The whole tenor of the game changes on that.
Yeah, so just before half-time, or was it a few minutes before half-time?
Yeah, 44 minutes, I think, something like that.
Ball comes into Van Persie.
Beautiful cross from Dali Blind.
I mean, it's a fantastic goal.
Which is better, the cross or the header?
It's the two together, I mean.
Yeah. I don't know, for me...
Which is better, bones or blood? You need a both.
blood.
The age-old debate. Yeah, I mean, the header is superb. The way Van Persie did. I mean, are you surprised he takes it on the head? Because he could sort of control
Yeah,
it.
I mean, I can't think of any other goal I've ever seen like that.
Yeah.
And you know, people describe it as a diving header, and I sort of understand why, because of that fantastic photo of him sort of almost horizontal. But actually, it's not quite that. He runs on, and he just sort of checks his run as the ball sort of arcs back into him. He's obviously got the awareness that Casillas is off his line, so there's a chance to sort of pop it over him. And then the sort of thrust he gets on the header is what carries him into that horizontal position. I mean, he's still sort of... he's checked, but he hasn't fully stopped. His momentum's still going forward.
Yeah.
But it's not a diving header in the way of, you know, a classic Andy Gray diving header against Sunderland.
Why did you have to choose Andy Gray?
Because he was good
at diving. You could have chosen Alan Shearer.
Why would I choose a Newcastle player? Have some decency. Keith Houchin.
Have some decency. You're talking about Andy Gray. All right, Keith Houchin. Yeah, okay.
You know, incredible awareness, incredible technical skill, incredible sort of control of the neck muscles. But in a sense, not a diving header.
No, because, yeah.
So I went through a spell of hating that goal because it's not a diving header. But then seeing it again, it's incredible.
It's incredible. It's basically going through, like, doing all the this incredibly complicated calculations in his head, and where's the goalkeeper, where's the ball, what is my neck capable of taking, and just coming up with a solution that you don't even see until he's come up with it.
Yeah, and you can almost see it in Van Persie's eyes working that all out. But if he missed that chance, people would think, what on earth were you doing, man?
Yeah.
You could have taken that down or something, but he scores and he runs straight over to King Louis.
Yeah,
and the celebrations begin. And as you say, there's a real kind of sea change at that moment.
Do you know what's really nice is seeing how happy Louis is.
Yeah,
like, especially at the end of the game.
I don't think we've seen him happier.
With a big grin on his face, it's Louis sort of saying, "Yeah, you all doubted me back when we got beat by the Irish in 2001. Look at me, look at me, absolutely gobbing Spain."
Do you think that Ireland result went through his head at that moment?
I mean, anybody who's not thinking of Jason McAteer at all moments, there's something wrong with them. I don't know, but I mean, it was a sort of restoration, wasn't it? It was sort of...
Well, especially as he'd failed with, you know, in that qualifying campaign.
Yeah, his career, coming back at RZ and winning the league was the beginning of it. But this sort of confirmed, actually, this is a career with two peaks, and that's a rare thing.
Yeah, marvellous thing.
And United fans as well, who suddenly started... literally salivating at the prospect of Van Persie and Van Gaal working together. Like, this is going to be a new era. It's going to be fantastic. And that was the peak of their optimism.
An era of sorts, certainly. So yes, the teams come out after the second half, and Robin puts them 2-1 up on 53 minutes. But again, even for my money, the game is still kind of ebbing and flowing. I know there's
been
a goal
is an amazing goal.
It is, and I know there has a bit of a sea change, but the sea change for me is the Dutch are just suddenly feeling more confident, really.
Well, they're feeling more confident, and it's really obvious how weak Spain are defensively, how vulnerable they are. So, I mean, I don't want to say it's a long ball because that's a bit unfair, but it's a long pass from Blint again, who you do think United misused after Van Gaal had gone. What a left foot he had. And then Robin takes it down, an incredible touch to take it down, and just sort of dances past Pique, and the aesthetic of the goal slightly spoiled by Ramos just getting a nick on it, but still, it's.
He'll try and spoil anything.
Yeah, he will. That's true.
You know, so at least the ball did go in the back of the net.
I mean, he'd be taking a hacksaw to Rembrandt's paintings without being paid for it.
Yeah, he decided it's too big. I'll take it from here, and it's too. And it'd be even Iron Robin though, one could have thought are his best days behind him. Yeah, in that opening game,
he's so quick.
Didn't he clock the fastest sprint ever in football or something? In that,
I mean, that sprint his for the goal. For the fifth goal, his second. I mean, we'll come on to that.
But yeah,
that's ridiculous.
Yeah,
in the 80th minute of a game,
and it's hot. It's so hot. It's incredibly humid.
Yeah.
I saw Robin when he was 19 play for PSV. I'd never heard of him before, and I happened to be in Waalwijk. And went to RKC Waalwijk against PSV and watched this sort of, I mean, a man who looked about 60, this sort of stooped, shaven, you know, balding, thin man, absolutely devastating, a lumbering fullback who I later learned to be Cali Boularus, scored a hat-trick. And I think Keshman might have got a hat-trick as well that day in a 6-1 win.
But What a collector's item.
Yeah.
He's the guy that, I mean, if Robin turns up at your five-a-side game and he's on the opposition team, you don't peg him as a threat instantly.
No, you don't.
Like Van Persie, you think, okay, he's got something about him.
Yeah.
Schneider, he looks like, he looks wily.
De Jong looks like he'd be quite a handful in the centre of the pitch, you know what I mean? But
yeah.
You're right, when you think of Iron Robin, you wouldn't have thought that. But anyway, he puts them 2-1 up. And then the third goal, this is when it really begins to...
Well, Van Persie smacked against the bar.
Oh, yes, of course.
A brilliant volley with another Robin run. But at this point, Spain have got all the possessions, all being played in the Dutch half. Every time they put it over the top, they get in.
But when he hit the bar, I remember thinking...
And that would have been a stunning goal.
That would have been a peach. I remember thinking, God, blimey, Spain, what are you doing? You've got away with that. You're lucky there, because that, 3-1, but again, expecting them to kind of... turn it round.
Yeah, and in the basement of the stadium, I'm thinking, well, Diego Costa is becoming increasingly marginalised.
When's he going to get his moment? Yeah.
He's drifting out of the game. I think he gets subbed after an hour, which when normally
gives you time to.
Yeah, so you enjoyed the last half an hour of the game then?
Not really. I'm thinking, oh gosh.
This is a technical journalistic thing. There is no worse job or no tougher job in football match reporting than the live sidebar.
Yeah, writing. And there's kind of an opinion analysis piece on a game that is still not finished.
Yeah. And so what you do, you often go into the game having picked a subject, thinking this feels like the key topic. Mm. And then after sort of 15 to 20 minutes, you have to kind of commit to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And once you've done that, there's no going back.
You basically have to push the button on it after 85, 90 minutes.
Yeah.
That's when you literally have to press send. And so, obviously Costa's the story. And then even at half time, which is your main sort of block of writing, thinking time, which for me was mostly spent going down the five flights of stairs past, Brazilians getting their Brahma beers and and trying to get their hot dogs. But that I'm thinking, well, obviously this is a story about Costa not quite hitting the mark, but Spain still finding a way, because you think they're still going to find a way.
He'd won the penalty. So he
won the penalty.
Yeah, he'd been involved.
There's something to hang it on. And then he comes off after an hour, and then everything goes to shit.
Oh dear. Well, yeah. So on 64 minutes, De Vrij sort of bundles one in, and this was, you'd say, the first of Casillas' errors. I mean, the ball comes in.
Yeah, I mean, I think he would feel that he was fouled by Van Persie, and I think another ref might have given that as a foul. But yeah, it's just a deep free kick, and De Vrij. I mean, I'm not sure De Vrij kind of tries to make any contact with the ball, just sort of hits him at the back post and dribbles in.
Yeah, and that was a bit. Hang on, this is happening, isn't it?
Even when they were, even when they were kings of the possession football, Spain were always pretty good at set pieces.
Mm.
Especially when they had Piqué and Ramos in there. You very rarely.
Well, and Puyol before that as
and
well.
And Puyol before
You think of the semi final in 2010 when. Yeah, they're dominating Germany, but the only goal they get is the Puyol header from a corner. Yeah.
There's that classic Henry Winter intro from that game. Nobody expected the Spanish Inquisition in the air.
Right.
Yeah.
So back to this game. Spain have a goal ruled out for offside, which would have been 3-2, of course. So they're still in the game again. I can't. Watching this game back, I was thinking, even at 3-1, you're thinking, but Spain are still... I know they look terrible at the back and they're all over the place in Casillas.
Yeah, I mean, the third goal and then the following 10 minutes, just remember Miguel sort of... It's ludicrous. What is this? It's ludicrous. What's happening? he's outraged at the universe for letting this happen.
Who did he blame?
The gods.
Yeah.
Not Del Bosque.
No.
Okay.
Because he's normally very good at coming up with... One scapegoat.
This was the universe at fault.
Yeah. Oh, it wasn't Del Bosque, no?
No.
That 3-1, I think, is the last point at which that Spain team have the aura of that Spain team.
Yes.
That's when it goes.
Yeah.
Between about 60 and 70 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely right. I think that's the point I'm sort of labouring to make, is that even at 3-1, you think, come on, there's still Spain.
Yeah.
And then when the fourth goes in.
When the fact it's a mistake, it's almost like Sergio Ramos's brain's been scrambled by this as well. The short back pass.
But it's not just the fourth goal, as you say, Jonathan. It's the manner of the fourth goal. Even they have stopped believing, I think, in themselves at this point.
So, short back pass. Casillas sort of slightly bottles out of it and goes with his feet, ends up sort of kicking it onto Van Persie, who just sort of wanders around him and pops it in.
Yeah.
And suddenly, it's a bit like, I suppose you do get this, but it reminded me a little bit of when England beat the Dutch in 96,
mm-hmm.
of this sort of, you're suddenly witnessing a game you expected to be tight, you probably almost expected the other team to win it, and suddenly it gets to three or four. You know, when Shearer scored that second goal, his second goal in 96, you sort of thought, we've won this.
Yeah.
And this must be the moment when the Dutch thing, you know, Van Persie must have had that great moment of an empty net to just kick the ball into, and suddenly you're 4-1 up, and there's, 18 minutes to go. You're not going to lose.
No.
We've won the game.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a glorious moment, and the Dutch fans will remember probably that moment very, very fondly indeed. And against the holders as well, keeping up that odd tradition of in the 21st century of holders struggling in the first round, other than what Brazil in 2006 they went through. But France in 2002 went out in the first round. Italy 2010 first round. Spain 2014 first round. And then of course Germany 2018 first round. Like it's such a weird, almost sort of phenomenon. As you say, Brazil are the only ones that have bucked that trend.
Yeah, it's. I mean, like what we touched on earlier, I think going into a tournament as defending champions almost, I don't know, it feels like it kind of puts you at a disadvantage, because then you don't really have the motivation or the kind of the instincts, I guess, to be constantly innovating. And you know, you have a formula that has worked for you in the past, and I think you generally tend towards sticking to that formula, even when something different is obviously required.
Yeah, because I think for a long time it was easy to think, oh, it's because you haven't played qualifiers, but obviously now you do have to play the qualifiers.
Well, yeah, it's changed a bit, hasn't it?
But I think I think particularly with Germany, this was obvious that refreshing the squad is a very hard thing to do, because there's always going to be a bit of a divide between the lads who won it last time and the new lads who've come in.
Especially with that Spain side having had such success.
Yeah. And I guess Diego Costa,
the
correct sidebar, exemplified this.
Yeah, yeah. They had Koke, who'd had an incredible couple of years with Atletico, and he could barely get in the side.
And he would have added dynamism to that midfield.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was good in
20. But then who do you drop at? You got Busquets, you got Xavi, you got Xabi Alonso.
But again,
they're all great players.
We've got this in hindsight, you know, going into that tournament, again, knowing that Spain side with the manager, blah, 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 it would have been a bold thing to do.
Yeah, well, this is what the second edition piece that I got. after the final whistle, where I had maybe about an hour or an hour, hour and a quarter to come up with something completely new, and I ironically took a hatchet to my first piece and just produced something completely different.
Did you probably bash the laptop off as well?
I went off to. I mean, you can't do a full post mortem of this era of Spanish football, but you can look at the personnel and some of the decisions that got made in the 2 to 4 years before that. And, I think Del Bosque was understandably quite loyal, like extremely loyal to the players that had won him stuff in the past. And if you look at maybe the 5 or 6 years of like Champions League football and international football going into that tournament, what we saw towards, in 2013, 2014 was this era of control giving way to a kind of a slightly more chaotic, a chaotic tone, especially in these big games. It was like a couple of months earlier that Guardiola's Bayern had gone up against Real Madrid, and there was a similar kind of collective intake of breath when I think it was Real on 4-0, 4-0, and
yeah, you're right. It's very similar feeling of kind of suddenly you see the crack appears in the wall, and then suddenly the wall collapses.
Yeah,
yeah. There's very little in between.
Yeah, over the course of about 20 minutes that happened.
Yeah,
they just got picked off on the break again and again and again, because Angel Di Maria actually is a good player.
Yeah, indeed. But yes, I mean, we talked a bit about the fifth goal.
Well,
I think we should go back to it.
I think I could watch Ian Robin sprinting like that all day. I mean, it's just a basic ball over top.
Yeah.
But the great thing is that you see Sergio Ramos, who's got about a 4 or 5 yard start, and you see immediately he knows he's not going to catch it. He's sort of beckoning other people over to help me out. As this whir of legs zips past him.
It is phenomenal.
And then what's great is that Robin gets the ball, Casillas has come out to close it down, Ramos is, you know, catching him up. And he just stops. And Ramos goes flying past him and he turns back and then dribbles sort of across, you know, laterally across the box.
Yeah, well, he will do that, Robert.
Keeping on, yeah. He cuts in.
Yeah, even if he came in from the left, he then sort of had to go back a little bit to make sure
he cuts in field under his left foot.
Yeah,
yeah. dummies to shoot. And poor Casillas is just sort of crawling after him by that point.
Yeah, you're thinking he's the chance is gone. You're thinking he's missed his opportunity. But what's happening is that they say that during moments of high trauma, the world sort of goes in a bit of a blow, and you can clearly see that Ramos and Robin are experiencing time at two different speeds at that point, and with an extremely comical result.
Indeed, yeah. But that is, again, with Van Persie's fourth goal, you know, when you say it all kind of, it falls apart for Spain, this is, the Dutch are almost torturing them now.
Yeah, I mean, fifth goals, I think, you could probably do a whole podcast on you know, the fifth goal is, I think, the point at which a convincing victory becomes a humiliation. There's you can almost paper over a 4-1.
I know what you mean. There's something, the difference between 4 and 5-1 is much bigger than, say, 3 and 4-1.
I think it's bigger than you know, the difference between anything apart from 0 and 1. It's
yes, I would agree with that. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
No, but I know what you mean.
No,
good teams occasionally concede 4 goals, but you know, Guardiola's Bayern lost 4-1 to Wolfsburg. It can happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lenin 5 is something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. All that was missing was an Emil Heskey goal, of course. You know. but yeah. So and Spain, next game they lose and they're out in the first round. I mean, them playing, was it Australia? Is it in a dead rubber?
Yeah.
It was, again, a very strange thing.
I mean, that Chile game was one of the favourite World Cup games I've done. Mm. I mean, it's such a great, an odd occasion.
2-1 Chile?
2-1 or 2-0?
2-0, I think, wasn't it?
Was it 2-0?
Definitely Chile got 2, I remember that.
Sure.
But also the Chilean fans invading the press box before the game. And
yeah.
It was, they had broken glass everywhere.
And they're just, much like the team, you know.
It was 2-0.
It was 2-0. Were they just swarming, you know, bodies everywhere?
Yeah, just red shirts all over the place. Hapless opponents chasing them. As
you're trying to get out, they're tugging the shirt.
Load of journalists and look on going... Yeah, filming it and taking notes.
Glorious. And then Netherlands, of course, would go out in the semis to Argentina.
The interesting thing is, in many ways, it's the Dutch who, after that game, who I think were as big a disappointment as Spain. You thought that they would kind of blitz a trail through this tournament now. And instead, what happened is that, as it turned out, playing a 5-2-3 against deep-set opponents did not make for very interesting football. And, you know, by the time they were scraping past Costa Rica on penalties, I think a lot of the magic of that game had already sort of dissipated.
Even the Mexico game, which was the last 16, they were 1-0 down until the water break, which allows Van Gaal to... But that was the other thing about those knockout games, was it somehow added to the Van Gaal myth, because you had the water break where he gave them a talking to and they then get the equaliser very quickly afterwards.
The two late goals, wasn't it?
And then the Costa Rica game, he substitutes the goalkeeper, brings on Tim Krul for Cillessen, which again seems like this kind of crazy genius. And it everything's sort of building to this is Louis's tournament, to the extent... I don't want to keep having a go at Miguel, but when I've got the opportunity, why not? Miguel didn't go to Germany 7, Brazil 1 in the semi-final. He went to a Louis van Gaal press conference instead.
Why?
I mean, he must have been directed there by the desk.
He was working for ESPN at the time, right?
No, I think he was at the Indy. I think so, yeah.
But even though the Netherlands, they went into the playoff match, they still gave Brazil a bit of a kick in.
Yeah.
You know, which seemed to be the thing to do in the latter stages of that tournament, of course.
I went down to Porto Alegre after that and for the Australia-Holland game. And this is a few days after they've just beaten Spain 5-1. And the Dutch journalists are giving Van Gaal such grief. They are asking him incredibly pointed...
I was at the Chile game. The dead rubber. They both gone through. Who's going to be? I mean, it's the same thing. There's all these questions about stylistically. Is this correct?
Yeah, is this the Dutch way? Is this how Holland should be playing? And I don't know if you've never been in a Dutch football press conference. The Dutch themselves are very, they're very blunt and uncompromising, especially when it comes to to press conferences, and he's getting loads and loads of questions about his tactics, which for somebody who comes from the English press conference tradition is really quite startling, because, you know, an English press conference, you've essentially got tabloid boys going, you know, have you sent a message to him? Just how good can Jackie Wilshere be? Uh-huh. You know, would you have a word with him? And suddenly you've got like two dozen Dutch journalists like interrogating Van Gaal about his tactics, which it was you know, quite telling.
Yeah, I mean, the point you make about that system not being as effective against teams as sit deep. Yeah, I've got the Van Gaal interview I did. I've got it on my screen here, and the thing I think is relevant there is he said that he made that switch of putting Robin into the middle to provoke the space behind the defenders of our opponents, which is fine if there is space behind the defenders of your opponents. But as soon as there isn't, it becomes quite blunt. And that was what you saw for the rest of the tournament and what you kept seeing at Manchester United.
Yeah, they didn't play another team who played into their hands like
that.
Absolutely. Jonathan, it's been a pleasure talking to you about that game.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah, that's it. The rest of the day's your own.
How long's that been?
Yeah.
That felt like about 15 minutes.
Yeah, we're just about 40 minutes in.
There's a point to be made there about how people perceive time. different.
I was very much like Sergio Ramos. I felt like I'd gone on for hours.
Yeah. Whereas you've Iron Robin'd that. Well, there we are, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, Jonathan Lewis. It's been an absolute pleasure. Jonathan Wilson, always a pleasure, of course. That was the Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. For more stories like that, do check out theblizzard.co.uk. We'll see you next week.
This was a Stakhanov production.